personal problem, I'm sorry about that. I declare the meeting open. And today we have two items on the agenda. We are going to be receiving a briefing from the Post Regulator of South Africa on its annual report. And we will consider and adopt minutes of the previous meeting, which was held on the 7th of October 2009. In attendance today, we have delegates from the Port Regulator of South Africa, Port Regulator, the Department of Transport, and the Ministry of Transport. I would like to take this opportunity to give over to Ms. Thuli Letswalo, who is in the Department of Transport, to introduce the people from the Port Regulator of South Africa. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. We have in our presence the Port Regulator, we have Mr. Riaz Khan, the Chief Executive Officer of the Port Regulator. We have
that we can see him, maybe if I show him.
We have Mr. Andrew Pike, who is the member of the Port Regulator. We have Ms. Pungzi Delangeni, who is also the member of the Port Regulator. We have Mr. Dr. Brian Goel, who is the member. And we also have Mr. Mohamed Ibi Faki, who is the board secretary of the Port Regulator. And with me, I have Mr. Jacob Nekwa, who is the deputy director from the branch Public Entity Oversight and Border Operations and Control. And I also have Mr. Dion Selyun, who is the acting director, Parliamentary Services and Stakeholder Management from the Ministry of Transport. And we also have Mr. Grant Frederick, who is the Deputy Director, Administrative Support in the Office of the Director General, and he will be joining us later. Thank you.
Thank you very much. On our side, we have members of the Portfolio Committee. I'm the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee. My name is Ruth Bengu. I will ask other members to introduce themselves and also indicate which political parties they represent. I represent the ruling party, ANC.
Good morning, thank you, chairperson. My name is Pundile Ngwenya Mabila, representing the ANC.
My name is Mr. Angan from the ANC.
My name is Jerome Make from the ANC.
Pakiso Poho from Congress of the People.
We have received an apology from Honorable Lucas from the IFP. He's not able to attend the meeting with us today. And we have also our committee secretary, who is writing an exam, who will be with us. There is with Annelle Felix in for her. Thank you very much. We will then be moving to the briefing by the Port Regulator of South Africa on this annual report. What we are expecting from the Port Regulator of South Africa is to present to us the programs that they have been involved in between 2007 and 2008. And also present to us what allocated in terms of financial resources in relation to that program, to those programs. and how they then executed their mandate, meaning that how did they implement the programs that they were expected to implement, and how did they expend the financial resources that were allocated to them. We would also be interested in knowing the challenges that are related to executing the mandate, as well as the allocation of resources, as whether there are any challenges around that. We would have appreciated if in the delegation there were members of the board. I don't know whether they are. Are they in here?
There are three members of the board. Dr. Carl, we don't have a board in a sense. What we have is regulator members that constitute this board.
We would be interested in knowing from them how the port regulator is governed from here, like from the board, and also at the level of CEO level. We would want to know the implementation processes and all those things. Because we are looking at two things. We are looking at the governance of the entity and its compliance with the governance regulation. We are also looking at the effectiveness of the entity in executing its mandate. And if there are any challenges relating to this, we would want to hear those and also hear from the board as to how they're dealing with challenges that are related to governance and executing the mandate. I would like to stop at that. And from our side, you can expect interrogation of what you shall be presenting to us, and also suggestions where we identify that there are gaps. And we would want to put it up front that in looking at whether the port regulator is executing its mandate and achieving what is desired, we don't only look at the programs that are implemented. We're also looking at the core relationship between the strategy that you are implementing and the policies of government, which are mainly informed by the policies of the ruling party. From the ruling party side, our first document that we need is the Freedom Charter, because that is what is the blueprint that is guiding transformation in this country. And we also use the RCP. We use the resolutions of all the conferences of the ruling party to see how those were effected at government level. And then we look at government policies in relation to transport and how the strategy relates to that, and how you then execute your mandate in relation to those that have just outlined. Thank you. And then the guidance that we give is the guidance that tries to bring closer the what is being done to what the ruling party has resolved to do in the country. I will now take this opportunity to welcome you to present to the portfolio.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning, Chair and members and colleagues. We thank you for the opportunity to present. It's the first time that we in actual fact, within the portfolio committee. And so we are quite, in a sense, there's a certain amount of trepidation as to exactly what the portfolio committee wants from us, but also we are looking for, in a sense, some kind of guidance with respect to trajectory, which we are sure that the committee will provide for us. In the putting together the presentation, what we mainly did was to outline what the regulator does and then deal with the specific instances coming out of the annual report, but more so about the AG's report. We do touch on some of the elements that was alluded to by the chair. There are some elements which we haven't dealt with expansively in the presentation. We were not aware of the extent to which we needed to deal with specific aspects to that extent, but we would be able to deal with those aspects in the discussions which occur. As to the elements highlighted by the chair, it's a critical element for us that the congruence between strategy of public entities and direction and leadership with respect to strategic trajectory and even strategic change along from time to time. Those things are important because collectively the DOT as a representative of the executive and the committee as a representative, transport representative of the legislature, in effect assist us in sharpening what we're doing in the right direction. So we look forward to getting some direction in some of the areas. In other areas, I think the committee and government has clearly articulated its perspective, but there are some spaces that we would like to have. So thank you very much, members. Basically, we'll go through the National Ports Act and the regulator mandate. We'll deal with the regulator programs and the main activities. And then we'll deal with the financial year 2007-2008 and 2008-2009 annual financial statement. Just in preempting a parliamentary question that always comes up, the cost of the annual report is 51 rand per unit. And in actual fact, it translates into 25 rand 50 cents per year because it deals with 2 years. Common question. The object of the National Ports Act, we went through the presentation because we presume there may be some new members on the committee, etc., so that we can just give them a context as well.
The new committee of the Water Parliament.
So we try to make sure that we explain ourselves adequately before. So basically the object of the National Ports Act is the development of an effective and productive port industry for economic growth and development. One of the objects as well is to promote and improve efficiency and performance in the management and operations of ports and to promote the development of an integrated regional production and distribution system in support of government policy. The National Ports Act actually flows out of the White Paper on Commercial Ports, which was issued in 2003, if I'm not mistaken, but which was a long process of engagement, a tripartite engagement between the public entities, the departments within government, such as public enterprises, national treasury, etc., etc., and labor, organized labor, dealing specifically with what are the outcomes that were required in setting up an effective market structure to deal with the port handling requirements, to ensure that we, in actual fact, have ports that deliver on the developmental objectives rather than acting as a brake on the one end, was specifically targeting aspects of our development and not looking at others. A common challenge which is found all over the world is that those with the most resources and therefore the most lobbying capability, they always tend to be looked after because they have access to resources, they can put their head on the table. But as a developmental stage, it's very critical for us to ensure that we do not only articulate the developmental needs of, as an example, a large export-driven mining company that just moves stuff out of the country. We also have to look at the requirements of the rest of the economy and specifically target both the policy perspective but also the resources of the state in the direction of an overall and balanced development right across the country and not only articulate specific areas. So as an example, in our response to those particular objectives, we can't only concentrate on large multinational or even large South African entities and what they wish to move to port, but we also have to deal with aspects currently are with respect to what are the rights that subsistence fishermen have around these facilities, as an example. Because we have to deal with, we can't deal with South Africa as the sole representative of South Africa being the owners of the multinational companies. We have to deal with the entire South Africa within the context of the policy. And that policy then flows through into the aspects of the port. The background, the Act contains the mandate and functions of the port regulator and the National Port Authority. It was enacted on the 26th of November 2006. It has not yet been fully implemented in a couple of areas. For example, the MPA is not yet corporatized, and the port regulator is not yet fully operational in all the mandate areas. The structure of the Act basically is the Act, which comes out of Parliament, the regulations which are issued by the Minister of Transport, and the directives which are issued by the port regulator. The Act says the legal context decides which powers go to which entities at which level and what each of those powers may what each of those entities may exercise, either as the Minister of the Port Regulator or the MPA. The regulations deal specifically with setting the context for the industry and what are the legal rules which govern the industry. With respect to the directives issued by the port regulator, it's primarily how we run the business of the port regulator and what consideration we take into our decision. The functions of the port regulator are set out in the Act to exercise economic regulation of the port system in line with government's strategic objectives, to promote equity of access to ports, facilities, and services provided in ports, to monitor the activities of the National Ports Authority to ensure compliance with the Act, to adjudicate complaints and appeals against the authority, to approve or reject the authority's tariffs, to promote regulated competition, and to regulate the provision of adequate, affordable, and efficient port services and facilities. In general, the objectives of economic regulation, as articulated in the port policy, amongst others, but particularly in a generalized sense, but particularly dealing with the ports, is that the objectives of this economic regulation should be the promotion of efficiency, the promotion of investment, protection of port users, prevention of pricing and service discrimination, prevention of anti-competitive practices, competition among ports, and competitive and affordable tariffs. The purpose of access to ports, facilities and services is a movement of goods for the import and export markets, as well as domestic and regional distribution. Access by HMMEs and BBBEE companies, improving international trade and promoting efficiency and reliability of port services and facilities. Competition in the port system, which is one of the mandates in terms of implementing a regulated competition. The Port Act requires the regulator to promote regulated competition in the industry within the context of what state policy is with regard to those particular market rules. The port system must be locally, regionally, and globally competitive to ensure that it does not act as a brake on our economic and industrial development. The NPA is a monopoly which has to be regulated and monitored. In addition, port users must also have a choice in facilities and services, and they must have access to those facilities. The function of the National Ports Authority in terms of the Port Act. The main function of the authority is to own, manage, control, and administer ports to ensure their efficient and economic functioning. The Act does outline the detailed functions of the authority, which we've stepped over. Quite a few phases of those. But they would generally deal with ensuring that the port operates effectively and efficiently, providing whatever services are required. How does the NPA discharge its function? It discharges its functions in a range of ways. It enters into agreements with third parties to provide port services and facilities. It issues licenses through competitive bidding for the provision of port facilities and services, and there's a certain amount of self-provision of services and facilities which are within the context of the NPA that are not either licensed out or agreement entered into for the delivery thereof. The programs of the regulator, administration, economic regulation and tariffs, monitoring and compliance, criminal and regulatory development, and industry development. regulators have a role to play in the National Ports Authority agreements and licenses, and that is to monitor the issuing of licenses and conclusion of agreements with third parties for the provision of port facilities and services. Also, the appeal process of the regulator shall be an intervening platform in that regard. And the regulator has power to ensure that SMMEs and BBBEE companies are provided with access. Port compliance monitoring. The regulator shall monitor the NPA compliance of the Port Act in all the aspects that it has an obligation to comply. The regulator can monitor the compliance of the complaint and appeal processes as well. And in addition, the reporting on compliance will be on an annual basis commencing 2010-2011. Economic participation in the port system. The regulator shall ensure participation of private operators, SMMEs, and BBBEE companies in the port system by creating an enabling environment, or ensuring that. The port market structure shall be determined by the framework for participation that is issued by the Minister of Transport. We believe it will be issued next year sometime. Barriers to entry must be addressed in the port environment, and employment creation and economic growth of the port system must be achieved. The assessment of authorities' tariffs. In terms of the Act, the NPA is required to submit proposed tariffs to the port regulator. These tariffs cover all NPA activities as a port authority. The NPA is required to publish for comment. The regulator will hold hearings and invite submissions on proposed tariff increases. And after the consideration of submissions, the regulator shall approve or reject some or all of the tariff increases. Are there elements within the proposed tariff that need to be articulated by the National Port Authority to allow to engage with? These should be the manner of calculation and the model whereupon which they've reached to come to a particular response that they have. They have to provide us with all financial information and valuation. They have to articulate what their reinvestment of profits and revenues are within the port system, and they must regulate the impact on port activity cost structure. The purpose of the NPA tariffs in our consideration are to enable the NPA to recover its investment owning, controlling, and administering ports and its investment in port services and facilities, to recover its costs in maintaining, operating, controlling, and administering ports and its costs in providing port services and facilities, to make a profit commensurate with the risk involved in port services and facilities. What is the regulator's role in those tariffs? To ensure that the NPA tariffs are utilized in ensuring that the port system is efficient, to ensure that the tariffs are affordable to port users, to ensure that the tariffs are predictable and non-discriminatory, and to prevent the utilization of tariffs for cross-subsidization unless in the public interest. Filing of prices by service providers. All port service providers must lodge a detailed and comprehensive list of prices charged for port services within 6 months of the publication of the directives, which were published on the 6th of August this year, or within 6 months of the commencement of a port service. And we've inserted the definition of from the Port Act, and it means stevedoring, cargo handling, terminal operations, storage of cargo within a port, tug services, floating crane services, berthing services, firefighting, security, radio and radar services, waste disposal, vessel repairs, and any other services provided within the port which are designated as such by the authority by notice in the Gazette. Now, those particular port services some of them are generally done mostly by the NPA, some of them are done by the terminal operators, and some by other operators. So there's both public and private sector components. And just a question which may arise as to why we require the filing of prices by service providers. In our interventions within the tariff processing, we have to ensure that we don't merely transfer value from one balance sheet to another, which does occur within some regulatory environment, in that the regulated entity has a pricing, has pressure on its pricing from the regulator. What happens then, all the service providers that take services from that regulated entity
They don't change their pricing models at all. So what happens, the regulator comes in, strips out value as mostly a public company, and prevents them from making profit, but it has no real change on the pricing structure in the port, because the other players in the port just continue increasing their prices at massive rates. So no matter what the intervention of the regulator is, you end up with effectively, I mean to appreciate, effectively you're taking value from a public company, a publicly owned company, and you're transferring it to a privately owned company, which is not the role of the regulator. The regulator is to look at the overall cost structure within the industry and what exactly the impact is on the entire community of South Africa, but particularly on the port. Appeals and complaints, we do run a quasi tribunal, and we shall adjudicate appeals from port users and complaints from any person affected by decisions and actions of the NPA. The regulator can issue appropriate orders in resolving appeals and complaints, and the regulator accepts appeals and complaints in line with its directives, which have been published in the Gazette. Current activities of the regulator is the economic review of participation in the port system, the implementation of the port regulatory framework, the adjudication of appeals and complaints, maintaining the regulator's secretariat and system, implementing the tariff regulation framework and port compliance monitoring. The next is just the phases of the regulator dealing with some 2005 phases. 2005 is in the Act of Bill, thank you, Parliament, amongst others. The Act was promulgated in 2006. The first meeting of the regulator was in March 2007. Offices were established in December 2007. The CEO was appointed in July last year, and the directors and principals were finally approved and published in August 2009. Now, at the bottom is the level of emphasis and effort, so where the concentration of the organization has commenced over time. After the first meeting, the regulator members concentrated mainly on defining the regulatory policy issues, what those implications were for a regulator, and how to articulate that going through into directives amongst others. They also work on the establishment of operations, which they commenced at that stage. The offices and the physical infrastructure being set up by December 2007. After that period, there was a finalizing of the initial regulatory framework, which is dealing with the directives, etc. So after that, articulated to a greater or lesser degree, depending on the clarity within the policy environment, as to what the particular implications were in the regulator's operations arising from the port policy and from the various statements which have been made in that regard. So the finalizing of that initial regulatory framework commenced in that central period in 2007. In 2008, there was work started on developing a second round regulatory framework element, because as the rolling operationalization of the regulator occurred, What happens is that you're then able to deal with greater and greater levels of sophistication as you're going down the line. And the implementation basically started after March 2007, taking into consideration the members are all part-time members, and only the appointment was in July 2008, and then the offices had more people. So that implementation has been gathering momentum over time. Would the chair like us to stop here for some questions or deal with us financially? Financial year 2007-2008 and 2008-2009 annual financial statements. The overall audit opinion was for both years we had no disclaimers or qualifications, which we believe is quite exceptional for an entity which is established from scratch. There were emphasis on matters in both years which we deal with below. The only significant event was a fruitless expenditure of 13,000 rand out of a budget of then 12 million, 11 million, and it was related to interest on late payment of rental for officers. It resulted from the dual compliance with which we have been operating. In general, what happens is that the port regulator processes the payment. We wait till we get an invoice. We take the invoice, we then process the invoice and we submit it to the Department of Transport once we comply with all our internal processes for approval. The
DOT then processes and checks it, and the DOT then effects payment in that regard. What happened during this time is that the person who had previously been working on it in the Department of Transport left, and so there was no particular person that was responsible for doing this. There was a range of people working with them in the Department of Transport side. So they had a problem, but the moment that they got in the gap between the previous person who worked on it and Mumbulani, we had a couple of challenges with things slipping through the gap. But as soon as they appointed a permanent person that was directly responsible, that never occurred again. It is basically the rental which is paid to the landlord, which is paid late instead of the place it was supposed to, and they add on interest. So all of this occurred within the period that there was no dedicated person responsible for the permanent. But being corrected, it has never happened again since the appointment of a new person. Material amendments to accounts. There were material amendments to the accounts in both years. In 2007 and 2008 and 2009, the audited fees were accounted for in the financial year assessed. So what we did in the 2007 and 2008, we took the auditor's fees and we wrote it into that particular annual financial statement. In 2008-2009, we wrote into the 2008-2009 annual statement as well. The auditor general then told us that we have to correct that because they want us to, we have to make allowance for the auditor fees in the year following the year that we're talking about. So if we're talking about year 7 and 8, the audit fees must actually be in year 8-9. So in 8-9, you see the audit fees for 7-8 being reflected and we get audited by the auditor general. And in 9-10, we will bring the next to the committee. The committee will see that we've taken 8-9 audit fees and we've written it in that particular year. With respect to 2007-2008, we, in the initial accounting submitted to the AG, we accounted for the total budget allocation. Because what happens in the relationship between ourselves and the Department of Transport, they don't transfer the whole budget across to us because we were using them to run only the payment function. So what they did is in terms of where we made an allocation, they would make that particular allocation and that's what we would do. So what the AG came back and said is that you mustn't put the whole budget amount in your financial, and it was never transferred to you. What you must look at is an actual allocation which was set up between that's what you should place in. So it was a technical amendment. Instead of us showing revenue of 12 million, for example, we would have to show revenue of 9 million as an example. So because that was the only year it was done in the next year financials, after we had submitted the first one, and they told us about it, that as a first run, we then amended the next one which is submitted, which was submitted on time. The matters of emphasis and the explanations report, grades 7-8 and 8-9. Financial management report as per annual report, emphasis of matters for 7-8, basis of accounting. The entity's policy is to prepare financial statements on the basis of accounting determined by National Treasury, as set out in accounting policy note 1. Those are the two changes that were made. The basis of accounting which is different, and that the auditor fees changed from the one as explained earlier, and the other one is restricted to the total budget accounted versus the transfer accounted. Material underspending of the budget. The entity has materially underspent its budget to the amount of 7.3 million. This is attributable to the fact that the entity is in its infancy stage and is not fully operational in terms of its mandated function. The budgetary control, our comments are the ones in italics, ensure that the funds were not wasted on unused functions of the fourth regulator. Those functions that we couldn't commence at that stage, we didn't go ahead and spend the money on a whole bunch of stuff. The regulator showed restraint and said, until those functions are active, we're not justified in spending that money, and therefore we have to deal with that particular process. As the fourth regulator becomes more operational, its financial performance will improve to ensure that the fourth regulator's expenditure remains within its approved budget. Capacity to expend growth over time as well. The comment of the AG, the accounting authority does not have effective, efficient and transparent systems of financial and risk management internal control in place, according to Section 51(1)A of the TPMA. The Department of Transport procedures have been followed since regulatory documentation needs to be approved and policies and procedures of the regulator put into place. At that time, they just thought to me, it was the first year of the regulator, so none of those policies and procedures were in place. The Department of Transport was actually new. So the entire process and all the policies of the DOD were implemented in the request of that. The governance framework, the PHMA tasks the accounting authority with a number of responsibilities concerning financial and risk management of internal control, fundamental to achieving this is the implementation of key governance responsibilities. The annual financial statements were not submitted for auditing as per the legislation deadline as set out in Section 55 of the PHMA. That is related to the year 7-8 that was corrected. There's a late submission due to no staff in place. After I was appointed, I recommend the process of putting together the financials, and those financials were submitted to the AC, although they were submitted late. Emphasis of matter 7-8 continues. The public agency had no audit committee in operation throughout the financial year. Finance, audit, and risk management committee was a single committee at that stage, and it did continue as a single committee to 08-09. The next comment from the AG was that the audit committee does not operate in accordance with approved list in terms of reference. Once they say that there is no audit committee, then all the other things that follow. And so it would be the same that the finance audit and the risk management committee was a single committee, and the terms of reference was for the integrated committee. There wasn't a specific audit committee. It was just a subset of the combined committee's terms of reference. The audit committee did not substantially fulfill its responsibilities for the year as set out in Section 77 of the PHMA and Treasury Regulation 27.1.8. The audit committee will be fully functional once the chairman has been appointed and the COR approved. That's the response to that one. Public entity had no internal audit function in operation throughout the financial year. The limited operation in place at the time. And the DOC performed the de facto financial oversight with respect to internal audit, because no payments were actually made by the regulator, they were made by the DOC. The internal audit function, the AG's comment, does not operate in terms of an approved internal audit plan. There's a limited operation in place, and the DOC performs the de facto financial oversight with respect to internal audit. The internal audit did not substantially fulfill its responsibilities for the year as set out in Treasury Regulation 27.2. There was a limited operation in place, and the DOC performed the tax of financial oversight with respect to internal audit. There are significant, AG's comments, there are significant deficiencies in the design and implementation of internal control in respect to financial and risk management. The risk management system was being developed at that stage. And it hadn't yet been completed. There are significant deficiencies in the design and implementation of internal control in respect of compliance with applicable laws and regulations. And the response was that there was a limited operation in place and the DOT performed the type of financial oversight with respect to internal audit. No risk, AG's comment, no risk assessment was conducted on a regular basis and no risk management strategy, which includes a fraud prevention plan, is documented and used as set out in Treasury Regulation 27.2. Was not in place for that year, subsequently being corrected. The information systems were not appropriate to facilitate the preparation of a performance report that is accurate and complete. Information systems were not implemented at that time. No adequate control processes and procedures are designed and implemented to ensure the accuracy and completeness of reported performance information. Those information systems were not implemented at that time, and the system was not in place. No strategic plan was prepared and approved for the financial year under review for purposes of monitoring the performance in relation to the budget and delivery by the Port Regulator South Africa against its mandate, predetermined objectives, outputs, indicators and targets as set out in Treasury Regulation 30.1. This was the first year of the existence of the organization. The organization had just had its first meeting in March of the beginning of the month just before the commencement of the financial year, so therefore they never had it. There is no functioning performance management system, and performance bonuses are only paid after proper assessment and approval by those charged with governance. A performance management system is being developed for implementation. We now move across to year 08-09 because this annual report spans 2 years. Basis of accounting. Comments by the AG,
The entity's policy is to prepare financial statements on the basis of accounting determined by the National Treasury as set out in Accounting Policy Note 1.1. The regulator has prepared its account in accordance with the policies of GAAP, Generally Accepted Accounting Practice. The AG recommended that we move to GRAP, which is Generally Recognized Accounting Practice. Both are acceptable forms of accounting practice, but Treasury wants us to do it with GRAP. So we then moved across the GRAP, and there are a couple of changes in terms of how you report the structure of the account, etc., etc., and we had made those changes for that particular year. Fruitless and wasteful expenditure, we highlighted that earlier. Contrary to Section 76(4)(b) of the PFMA, payments to a supplier were made after 30 days resulting in fruitless and wasteful expenditure to the amount of $13,000. This was due to penalty interest paid arising from the late payment of the rental for the premises occupied by the entity. The delayed payment is due to multiple control systems of the Department of Transport and the Force Regulator being applied to each payment. Therefore, over-control and checking is responsible, but it was due to a specific gap in the time, and it wasn't even for the whole financial year, which is for periods of it. Implementation of financial policy procedure and system at the regulator is completed. So in the process of moving towards shifting the entire financial function across to the regulator, it was the 1st of November. Emphasis of matters, material underspending of the budget. The entity has materially underspent its budget to the amount of $2.8 million. This is attributable to the fact that the entity is in its infancy phase and not fully operational in terms of mandated functions. That's the comment of the agent. Response to the regulator, as the budgetary control ensured that funds were not wasted on unused functions of the port regulator, and expenditure was appropriate for the level of legal instruments in place at that time. As the port regulator becomes more operational, its financial performance will improve to ensure that the port regulator's expenditure remains within its approved budget. KG's comments, the accounting authority does not have effective, efficient and transparent systems of financial and risk management and internal control in place, contrary to Section 51(1)(a) of the PFMA. The Department of Transport procedures followed since regulatory documentation needs to be approved and policy procedures and regulators are put in place. All policies are subsequently being developed. Governance framework. The PFMA tasks the accounting authority with a number of responsibilities concerning financial and risk management and internal control. Fundamental to this is the implementation of the governance responsibilities. The financial statements were subject under that sub-heading, AG's comment. The financial statements were subject to material amendments resulting from the audit. And as indicated before, that the auditor fees were accounted for in the financial year assessed, and we shifted it to the next year in accordance with the AG's recommendation. The public entity had no audit committee in operation throughout the financial year. Finance Audit and Risk Management Committee was a single committee. The audit committee was established and meetings held as a component of the combined committee. Committees are now separated into three separate committees for their own CEO. The audit committee does not operate in accordance with approved written terms of reference. The integrated terms of reference of the committee was approved and was operating in accordance therewith. And although that was not in accordance with the AG's subsequent comments, in actual fact it was operational, there was a written COR. Committees have now been separated into three individual committees with their own COR to ensure compliance in that regard. The audit committee did not substantially fulfill its responsibilities for the year as set out in Section 77 of the PFMA and Treasury Regulation 27.1.8. Finance Audit and Risk Management Committee was a single committee. The audit committee was established and meetings held, but as a component of the combined committee. The committee is now separated into three separate committees with their own COR. The public entity had no internal audit function in operation throughout the financial year. Multiple compliance and DOT financial oversight with respect to internal audit and control measures in place that resulted in no deviation from SCM standards, with a single exception of the late payment, which was unfortunately not helpful. Internal audit function does not operate in terms of an approved internal audit plan. Safe response. There was no
applicable compliance and a DOT financial oversight with respect to internal audit and the control measures in place resulted in no deviations from the supply chain management standards. Internal audit function did not substantially fulfill its responsibilities for the year as set out in Treasury Regulation 27.2. The same response is that there was multiple compliance in place and the DOT financial oversight, and there were no deviations found. In actual fact, both these audits, generally what happens in audits is they take a subset, they would decide out of 50 transactions, they would take 3 and then they would audit those transactions. In our engagement with the AGM, in actual, because of the issue that they asked them to audit all the transactions. So all our transactions have been audited, to the extent that the Auditor General sent us running around looking for a chair that was in the wrong office, and I mean, it went down to that level of audit, that we were able to ensure that in all the transactions we can go back and say that there was nothing, anything wrong with any of the transactions. There are significant deficiencies in the design and implementation of internal controls in respect to financial and risk management. Risk management was being performed on a high level, but was integrated into the operations of the organization and did not operate as a standalone, as per the AG's comments. The Treasury's risk management software is being acquired at the moment so that we can comply with a formal requirement, although we did comply with the substantive requirements of managing risk in the organization. There are significant deficiencies in the design and implementation of internal control in respect of compliance with applicable laws and regulations. The DOT policies were utilized where the regulated policies when the process were being developed. There was multiple compliance and DOT financial oversight with respect to internal audit. The control measures in place have resulted in no deviations from the SEM standards, and the appointment of staff was delayed until the regulatory instruments were in place. No AG's comment. No risk assessment was conducted on a regular basis, and no risk management strategy, which includes the fraud prevention plan, is documented and used as set out in Treasury Regulation 27.2. Risk management was being performed on a high level, but was integrated into operations of organization, and it wasn't operating as a standard of it. But it was not formalized to the extent that the Auditor General wants it, but it was in our current. The risk system is currently being implemented. The information systems are not appropriate to facilitate the preparation of a performance report that is accurate and complete. The system is being developed and implemented. No AG's comment, no adequate control processes and procedures are designed and implemented to ensure the accuracy and completeness of reported performance information. The system was being developed and implemented, is being developed and implemented. Currently, it's not automated, but is occurring. We don't have an IT system that runs whatever. We manage it in a non-automated manner. No strategic plan, AG's comment, no strategic plan was prepared and approved for the financial year under review for purposes of monitoring the performance in relation to the budget and delivery by the Port Regulators for Africa against its mandate, predetermined objectives, outputs, indicators, and targets as set out in Treasury Regulation 30.1. A strategic plan was developed and submitted to the DOT for approval, but no performance agreement was concluded in terms thereof. There's no functioning performance management system, and performance bonuses are only paid after proper assessment and approval by those charged with governance. A performance management system is being developed for implementation. Having dispensed with the comment of the AG with respect to the matter of emphasis, we just put some information together to highlight some of the financial performance of the organization and the utilization of funds, etc. Compared on a year-on-year, the port regulator budget increased by an amount of 238,000 rand, or 2.14%, from 11.144 million in 2007-08 to 11.382 million in 2008-2009. During the 2007-2008 financial year, the port regulator expended 2.39 million, or 21% of its budget. The expenditure pattern improved during the 2008-2009 financial year, with expenditure of 5.988 million, or 52% of its budget. The port regulator under expenditure during 2007-2008 was 8.754 million, or 78% of its budget, and 47.39% of its budget. Following in the comparison in budget versus expenditure, there are, we've dealt with the different years, the light blue being 2007 and 8. The, let's call it medium blue, being 2008-2009, and the dark blue being 2009-10, but that's the forecast amount. That's not the actual. That would be as at the end of the year, that's where we would be. The budget started out at 11,144, went to 11,382, and then up to 12,945. The expenditure started out at 2.3 million, went up to 5.9 million, and is now forecast at this end of the year to be 9.9 million. And as you can see on the right hand side, that the under expenditure has gone down from 8.754 to 3 million. Now, that under expenditure of 3 million there, for example, is not due to the organization not spending the money or not being able to spend the money. It's due to the fact that the responses, I mean, one of the things was the delayed conclusion of the directives and its publication, so therefore many of the operations could only come in later than budgeted for, and in addition, the reduced response which was expected. There was an expectation that there would be a lot more requirements for the tribunal functions, but in actual fact it's been less at this time than we had expected. So we don't want to spend the money unless there's an obligation to actually spend it. And because there's been a reduced uptake in the tribunal function, from our perspective, as we had planned versus what had occurred, we plan to underspend by that amount because that money we won't utilize. We set out the financial performance in the different areas. Administration was 2.2 million in 708 and 111,000 for monitoring. And if you go to the next financial year, you'll find that it's then split up into more functions. 3.7 million in the first year for administration, 859,000 for economic regulation and tariffs, 843,000 on monitoring, and 573 on tribunal and regulatory development. In the following year, administration goes down further to 3,214. The economic regulation and tariffs has gone from 859 to 2.5 million. Monitoring has gone from 843,000 to 923,000. Tribunal and regulatory development has gone from 573,000 to 3.2 million. Notice the number at the bottom is not our annual budgeted amount, which is allocated by Treasury. That is the number that we believe we will spend by the end of the year. So it's taking into consideration that 3 million will not be spent. In the program expenditure, the percentage of total, to give an indication of how the regulator is shifting certain portions of its activity. Administration, previously 97%, if I'm not mistaken, of the budget, has gone down to just over 30. Economic regulation and tariff from about 12 has gone to mid-20s. And you'd see at the end, it would be light blue, middle blue, dark blue, and there would be this reddish one. And the reddish one is the area where it's not being spent. Okay. The economic regulation and tariffs increase over that amount. There won't be unspent in that area. In monitoring, there will be an unspent component. That's due to the basis for monitoring is the economic review, and the economic review is being delayed. So that's where we'll make that particular saving, because the monitoring component wouldn't have been implemented at that stage. It will only be implemented after April. The tribunal and regulatory development spiked up from 10% to 33%, 32% of the expenditure, and that's where the saving is, the 3 million. Not saving. In effect, there's been a reduced uptake. So because less people are lodging complaints than we had expected, that provision won't be utilized in this particular area. Then the breakdown by classification, compensation of employees, starting out at 423,000, rising to 3.5 million by the end of this financial year. Goods and services, starting out at 1.9, went to 3.6, and then to 5.8. Depreciation, starting out at 52,000 to 398,000, and then eventually to 526,000 in the end of this financial year. Comparison expenditure, we've done a similar thing between 07-08 and 08-09 with the light blue and the dark blue breaking those up. With respect to BBBE actual versus target, in the first year of our reporting, which was 07 or 08, we hadn't had the targets established because it was the first year of operation. The targets hadn't been set this year. So we put 0% as a target, but the actual expenditure was 61.33. In the second year, the target that had been set in the E&Es was 30%, but the expenditure went to 59.82%. This is of discretionary expenditure, as an example, excluding the rental, which we don't have a choice as to. And in 2009-10, the target was 50%, we managed 83.61%. BBBE actual versus target, and that's just a graphical representation, with the light blue being what we had set the target as, and the dark blue being what we actually achieved. Employment equity, including the contract staff, for 07-08, it was male management, black male 100%, and staff female black 100%. In 2008-09, management 2008-09, male black 100%, staff male black 25%, white 25%, female black 50%.
Thank you very much. I will now give an opportunity to members to ask questions and actually interrogate the report. Is there anything that the board would want to say? No. Thank you. Over to the members.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think my question to in some way show that I'm not used to the ports regulator and its objectives, but you'll bear with me. On page 6, competition among ports, that would be bullet point number 6. That will definitely show my ignorance. Difficult to understand which port is competing against which one. I mean, it's just a simple question for me to be able to understand what actually is happening there. And then on page 18, bullet point number 2, just to fill in what I don't understand. If you say stiff touring or something of that nature, whatever it means, just to understand what that is, and betting services, because sometimes it becomes very difficult to follow if you don't understand some of these terms. And you talked about a quasi-tribunal. What would that be? What's the difference between that and some other tribunals? Why is it quasi? And then on page 34, the last bullet point, you said this was the first year of the existence of the organization. What was in place before this organization? As I apologized before, I don't have an idea, and maybe I will need to the next meeting. Then I will be in a position to kind of ask very concrete questions. And your spending pattern, because you always say that you didn't spend all your budget because the organization was not fully operational. Then Well, my question would be, how then do you estimate your budget if you don't have capacity to spend that budget? How do you get to a certain figure? Because you always underspend because you don't have capacity, as you say, or you are not fully operational. I think as of now, that would be my
question. Are there any questions, Honorable Gwenyaman?
Thank you, Chair. Let me start by thanking the CEO for the presentation. But I've got just a few clarity-seeking questions. Number one is on the employment equity. When looking at the slide, it says in 2007-2008, it's 100% black male. Then looking in 2008-2009, it's 100% black male, 0% is all white in management. But then looking at the people who are meeting with us here, there's no black male manager whatever. Maybe can I get an explanation on that one? And also maybe to get to the indication of the representation of the port regulator, which is with us here, because if they're saying there's no black, there's no white male, there was no white male in 2007, 2008, and also in 2008, 2009, the people who are representing the port regulator now, which position are they occupying in that and the entity. Again, coming to the female part of it, when looking in 2007-2008, 0% female in the management, 2008-2009, 0% female in the management. What is the problem of not capacitating or empowering the women in the sector? What challenges are they experiencing in recruiting women? Because I don't think that should tolerate a situation whereby there's no women in the management, in the decision-making structure of an entity, whether it's black women or white women, but women need to be there. Then the other one on the staff is an indication that black, 0%, female, 100%, white, 0%, 0%. In 2007-2008, when coming to 2008-2009, 25% male, 50% female. So what happened with the other 50% female, which was in 2007, 2009, did they resign or what? Maybe we can just get an indication on that one. And also, the reason for the entity not to employ white women, the 0% there on the staff, in 2007-2008. Maybe we can also get some highlights, Chair, on the issue of the people with disability, because it's a policy matter which must be implemented by all the government departments and also by all the entities, the 2% issue, which is a target, but it doesn't mean that we need to just limit ourselves in that 2%. Then, Chair, again, on the issue, when looking at the Act,
it talks about the Section 67 of the Act, if you relate it to page 14 of the slide and also page 12 of the slide, talks about the restructuring and reforming of the ports. Subsection C of that Section 67, it talks about the previous disadvantaged groups that they need to be taken care of, especially in the economic activities of the ports in terms of long-term leases. But when the presentation was made, I didn't get really how many previous disadvantaged groups were empowered, because it seems as if we were just talking about the expenses, the percent on the expenses. But the policy indicates clearly and the law indicates clearly that we need to empower previous disadvantaged groups. Can you get the specific number? How many were empowered? Then the other one, Chair, is on the issue of the Act, Section 81 of the Act, talks about the Port Consultative Committee, which must consist of 10 members. Do we have that committee in place? And also the Section 82 of the Act talks about the National Port Consultative Committee. Maybe if we can also have some highlights on those. Somewhere in your slides, you talk about the hearings that are dealing with the hearings and the appeals. But when the presentation was made, there was no indication of how many appeals or hearings have you conducted in the financial year, so that at the end of the day, we can get a picture of whether do we have any hearings or did we have any hearings or appeals that were forwarded to the regulator to be dealt with. So I think I've got many questions, so but just the few. Let me pause this in our contract. I will give the
contrary to what the member has raised, is not raising a concrete question. I think that's one of the most concrete questions with respect to competition among the ports and within the ports. One of the primary elements of the Ports Act was to drive the establishment of competition, which is a process which has commenced, and to ensure that there is competition between different port operators that move cargo. So, for example, if one facility was operating really efficiently, what would happen is that people would move their cargo to that facility rather than not having a choice of facilities or a choice of operators, which is the intention of the policy and the Act. So when the competition is amongst ports, it's mainly the main area of competition will be within a port, by different port operators providing a similar service. If somebody was moving liquid bulk, chemicals, for example, and somebody else was also moving liquid bulk, the competition would then be around price and efficiency and what each company thought was important, and then they could make those choices in terms of getting the best service at the best price that it was possible if they were competing terminals. So therefore it's about building that competition. Another issue around competition also is that we have standardized rates across many of the ports, and some of the ports could suffer as a result thereof. So you may find a port like East London, for example, that could be suffering with reduced outputs over time, or even if we should build smaller ports around the country going forward. That if there are differential structures and differential support mechanisms from the state, as well as within the port operations and pricing, it would be possible for them to be able to compete with the larger ports and still ensure that they get traffic in the smaller. But part of that process is being, in terms of the specifics, is being developed now in the engagement with the minister. When the minister issues his framework for participation, it will set out what the rules of competition and engagement are between ports and within the port. That should come out next year sometime, if that answers the question. With respect to stevedoring is mainly the labor function on the dock side. In terms of which people, for example, where they tie up stuff on the boats, etc., they assist with the moving of stuff on and off the boat. So it's the main labor function which occurs on the engine. Berthing services is where the National Ports Authority moves ships onto a particular berth, and a berth would be a place where a ship parks to be able to take cargo off and on and off. With respect to quasi-terminal, the reason I use the word quasi-terminal is because there is no separate tribunal in the regulator. The members are the regulator and the officers of the tribunal. So there's no separate tribunal like you find in the competition commission, where you find a competition commission on the one hand, and on the other hand you have the competition tribunal. So this is no such separation. The members are also the tribunal. With respect to 2007-2008 first year, before there was nothing before, there was no regulator function, there was no entity, there was actually nothing prior to that particular financial year. The first activity occurred in March 2007-2008. With respect to the spending patterns and the question of capacity and not fully operational amongst others, it's not only a capacity to spend, because capacity to spend is the ability to use money in a particular function. It's also about whether it's prudent to spend that money at that particular time. An example would be to set up a massive edifice to deal with specific matters, when at that time the regulations and the directives did not empower the regulator to do that as yet, because the regulator had not submitted the directives. Wouldn't effect have been spending a lot of money, which at the time would just let the ship and wait until the directives are completed for the function to be performed. So it's not a question of the capacity to spend, although it could, in some instances, be that. It's about all the instruments that needed to be in place to be able to spend and to promote that activity not being in place at that time. Employment equity, explanation, employee versus. There's a question of male and female, and the representatives. Just say, in terms of, I'm black. I may not look that black, but I am black in terms of the definition of employment equity in the country. So, I mean, that's what the 100% is related to. If there was a subset that the regulator, the members wanted a categorization that broken down to subsets, we can do that at some stage and bring the document, the numbers back again. But in terms of the people representing the regulator here at the moment, the only two staff members that are here are myself and Mr. E.B. Farkey. Mr. E.B. Farkey is classified as Indian and I am classified as colored. Mr. Garwin, Mr. Pike, and Mr. Langeni, they are members. They don't actually work in the regulator. They are our board and our members. They are all part-time. They are employed either in their own companies or for other companies. With respect to the makeup of the board, I mean, the thing is, these specific numbers, they look like they don't make sense, but it's actually a percentage of the total, because in the process we had used contractors to perform certain functions, so they would come in and come out. So those 25% and 50% are weighted as to the people that we utilize over time. They're not the actual, related to a set of people that have moved. With respect to people leaving the employer of the regulator, nobody has left the employer of the regulator. We haven't had staff that we've hired and then fired. There have been people who have come and done specific functions and then moved out. With respect to why no white woman is, we just hadn't, no white woman has been appointed in that particular process. People with disability, there was nobody that had a permanent disability, although one of our staff members did have a temporary disability. She had been injured in an accident, and in the process what we did when she came back, but that didn't occur in those years, occur now, is that she had previously been the person responsible for cleaning and catering, and then she'd been in an accident, and then she had broken both her legs and she couldn't move around, so what we did is we shifted her into reception, and she's going for training to become the receptionist. So we don't have any people with disability. We hope that Felicia's disability is in actual fact temporary, but she's being moved into the position of receptionist and being trained in that post, but she can't, and then we got somebody else in to take her post. With respect to the members of the regulator, there are eight members of the regulator, of which four are black females, two are white males, and two are black males. That is the makeup of the members, other than the staff numbers which are there. Okay, with respect to section...
Excuse me, Chair, if I could just add something to the CEO in response to the members' question. I think it's very important for members here to understand the distinction in the makeup of the regulator at present. There are the members to whom the CEO referred who are part-time, but fundamentally the members make the important decisions for the regulator, and the members meet on a monthly basis. Then there is the secretariat, which has been built at an organic pace depending on the development of the body. And so for a long time the only two employees in the secretariat were the CEO himself and the board secretary. And that's why the numbers appear strange, but it's because there have been very few employees and the number of staff are now starting to increase as the activities of the regulator increase. But the honourable member refers to the decision-making body, and fundamentally those decisions, or the main decisions, have been made at the members' level. And at management level, the CEO has been managing the day-to-day operations of the organisation.
Okay. With respect to Section 67, the restructuring and the reform of ports and the long-term leases, the question was how many were empowered and what the specific number is. That's actually a question we'd like to have answered as well, to be honest. We are in the process of doing an economic review of the ports. We have requested that information from the NPA. The NPA has come back to us and told us that they have a problem with the information systems and they can't provide the information to the extent that we require them. So they're going to go back and try and change the system to be able to give us the information. Basically what we asked them was the following. How many terminal licenses, agreements, deemed licenses, etc. there are? So how many licenses in total in the current port system are there? Who has those licenses and the rights to operate them? Are they BEE empowered, etc., etc.? To get an understanding, because in the economic review that we're doing, we need to understand what is actually occurring within the port environment from that perspective, so we are able to say that if this is the case now, we are monitoring the change over time. And also we wanted to know, in terms of the competition environment, what are the kinds of license conditions attached to each of these licenses? So, for example, and at the moment it's just deemed licenses, they haven't issued licenses except for stevedore. An example would be license one, is it a mini-maxi license? Is there a maximum amount of traffic they must move and a minimum amount? Or is it just a lease of square meters? Or what are the specific conditions attached to it? We can understand that when change occurs within the licensing environment, in actual fact, is it a question of the smaller licenses being made available to triple B, double E companies and women, or is it the larger licenses? In what way does it operate? So we can understand that change, so we can monitor that and report on that to Parliament and to everybody else. As to the specific number, we are waiting for them to come back with the information. It's been a bit of a while, but we hope that they will come back with the information as soon as possible. With respect to the Ports Consultative Committees, the Ports Consultative Committees were set up in every port in the country, which would be the commercial ports, with the exception of Port Nolloth. They've set up all the PCCs. There are some challenges where, for example, people are objecting to representation as to who and how people are represented on the Ports Consultative Committees. but where there are those objections, those are being resolved, because at the time when the nominations were made versus now, what has happened, some of the people may have moved on to somebody who was working in the municipality of Cape Town that was represented on the PCC, may have moved to, for example, Pretoria, and they're working for Minister of Finance, as an example. So to make those particular changes, those things are in the process. The National Ports Consultative Committee has not been established as yet. The Minister will convene the NPCC as soon as the each of the Ports Consultative Committees have nominated their representative to the National Ports Consultative Committee, because the Minister of Transport is the convener for the National Ports Consultative Committee, and he will call that committee together as soon as each of the PCCs on port level have submitted their nomination to the National. With respect to hearings and appeals, we were only empowered to have hearings and appeals after the 6th of August. The directives were published on the 6th of August this year, so prior to that, we could not have any hearings for on either appeals or complaints. We have one appeal which is in process at the moment, and that's with respect to the Port of Durban. We're in the stage of passing documentation between ourselves, the appellant, and the National Ports Authority, and that's with respect to the subsistence fishermen in around Durban. We have complained that the access to fishing inside of the port environment has been constrained by the decisions of the NPA, and they wish to appeal that decision so they can fish inside of inside of the harbour in certain areas. There are 785 appellants in that matter, so there are 785 people that are appealing the decision as a group. With respect to the others, we've had numerous engagements with port organisations, amongst others, and we believe that we've had 30 like formal engagements where people have said they want to raise a particular matter. But as to that translating into the documentation reaching us, we haven't had the documentation as yet. We've had two complaints which have been submitted, but they weren't in the proper form and content, but besides that, is that there was a confusion as to whether they were raising complaints or appeals. And we advise them to look at the directives and the act and decide where they thought they fitted in so they could appropriately respond to that. So, in actual fact, the currently running processes that we have with the documentation is all in place, submitted, etc., etc., there's only one appeal at the moment. I think that's all the questions.
Honorable Sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and apologies to the presenters here. I think I would have got you quicker by boat yesterday, or ship from the sun. Terrible weather, and unfortunately we had to spend the night there because of the problems. But anyway, I first want to say hello to Riyad, who I haven't seen for a long time, and congratulating him on at least getting a start going, but I think it's a long way. Go, because my question really goes back to the original process that we went through in the beginning when we prepared this act for Parliament and to get the regulator informed. And I think clearly the Green Paper spoke a lot about trying to break up some of the monopolies that existed there. And at the last minute, if you recall, during those deliberations and the public hearings, we had Maria Ramos, who was then the CEO of Transnet, step in and stop the process that we had, that the committee had agreed to, which would, in fact, look at the corporatization of the NPA within 3 years. So we extended that to accommodate the milking cow that they wanted, which is bringing in 5.1 billion or whatever it is a month, and said to them, look, under those conditions, the regulator would have to take, you know, heed of those processes, and they would be the body to enforce it. Because in terms of the Act, as I see it, you are the body that should have the teeth and the muscle to make things happen there in accordance with the principles of those Acts. And Madam Chair, I think we've really got to go back to that Act and have a look and to see whether certain things in there which had to take place have actually taken place in accordance with it, because if it hasn't, they're in contempt. And therefore, we need to then give this particular regulator the necessary teeth to be able to do what it's meant to do in terms of its mandate. Now, that doesn't, for 1 minute, mean that we've just got to go and hire people and, you know, spend money. But it certainly should give you the power to be able to do what you want. And I would like to ask that question now. What is it that you need now that you've got yourself, let's say, your feet on the ground and established a certain, let's call it, staffing structure, with minimum as it is, that you need effectively now to undertake what you legislated to do? I mean, that's the first thing. The second thing really is that the hearings and appeal process that you also mandated, it worries me that nothing has happened there other than the one that you just mentioned in the pipeline. But I know, and you know, that our ports are in total chaos. They are in chaos to the extent that if you go there, Madam Chair, which I wish we will go and have a look, even this one in Cape Town, the container harbour, the management of the process of collecting, taking out of there, the marriage, you name it, it sits there, it's an endless battle day in, day out for the commercial sector and the private sector to get goods in and out of that port. Now, I don't know where to put the finger, to point the finger, but I can tell you there's a lot of fat cats up there that are really not doing what they should be doing. I mean it, and I sincerely hope, Chair, that we will go there and look for ourselves with our own eyes. I mean, the management of the process of containers itself can be seen by the fact that you have trucks parked down the whole of Pond Island every day, sitting there with no toilet facilities. They have no, and I mean, this is the type of problems I get from constituents in that area saying to me, what are we going to do about these trucks? It's just a waste of time and money, basically. And I think we need to go and look at that and see what we can do to try and streamline that process there. The other thing that worries me, which we need to get down to and understand, is this whole lease agreement processes that were there that had to be audited and adjudged in terms of the old apartheid leases. There's people there on those docks and those ports that are getting properties at R3 a month or, you know. And we need to go there and assess what the situation is about that, because that's unfair advantages that were taken at that time, in due respect, and needs to be brought up into a market-related sort of situation where we can clearly say, well, look, you know, why should that person get away with prime dockside access to his goods and services at R3 a month when someone's having to pay R3,000 a month? And it really relates to a competitiveness process. And I think in the Act there was also a relationship that we wanted to build in there with the competitions board to bring that to the notice. And as muscle, we say to you, please, let's do that and get the level field or level. So, Madam Chair, I think that on that basis, I would just like to know from Riyad and his team here what we need to do now as legislators, as members of Parliament, to give him the muscle to be able to do what he wants in terms of the Act, because we are going to be slowly and surely creeping and falling behind in terms of some of the processes that was agreed to if we're not going to act quickly and get some of these things done, and whether in fact any means or processes are in place to audit the current lease agreements that are taken, so that are on our docks and at our ports, to see what the status quo is there so that we can if necessary also push the envelope, so to speak. Thanks very much, Madam.
Thank you, Chairperson. On page 23 of the slide, there's this fruitless expenditure of 13,000, which the entity indicates that it was due to the late payments of rentals for offices. We have the department here because the CEO indicated that the person who was supposed to process that was not available, so there were no delays. There was no one in the department. Can we just hear from the department what is the problem? Because I don't think that will allow fruitless expenditure, unnecessary fruitless expenditure to take place. That one is for the department to give us an explanation. Then again, Chair, on the issue of the audit committee. Can you just find out whether the audit committee was established in line with Section 79 of the PFM Act? Because there are some clear guidelines how we should establish the audit committee. Then, and also the reason why the financial statements were submitted late, because the PFMA is clear when the departments and entities are expected to submit their financial statements to the AG. They have to also find out about the offices which they have procured in the year under review, how many offices were procured in the year under review, then at what cost. And the other one, whether to, just to check whether do you have an approved organogram, because it's quite disturbing if there was no spread plan but there was a budget that has been allocated. Then you start to ask yourself, then how was this budget spent, because there was no plan in place. Just to get some highlights on this, Chair. Then the other one, when looking at the matters of emphasis as raised by the AG, although we were now we're dealing with two financial years on matters of emphasis, because I told about 2007-2008, but when looking at the responses on the matters of emphasis that has been highlighted by the AG, I just want to get my clarity on this limited operation in place, because in most of these in most of the matters that has been raised, then the entities saying limited operation in place, UT performance whatever. What do you mean? Because if there are matters of emphasis that has been identified by the AG, they're supposed to be planned in place to make sure that those matters don't come again in the next financial year. But I don't get it clearly, Chair, if they are saying limited operation, because in all the matters, this, in almost all the matters, there's this limited operation. Then to find out whether do you have any fraud prevention plan. If that plan, they have that plan, can that plan be forwarded to the committee, Chair? And also that performance management system, has it been finalized? The performance management system. Then the other one is the issue of the this understanding, Chair, which is a matter of concern. I think it has been raised by my colleague, but I didn't get the response clearly, because the regulator understands in 2007-2008, then again in 2008-2009. Can we get some reasons why there was this such understanding, 50%, almost 50% understanding in 2008-2009? That was the reason, because we understand the infancy stage where they were trying just to put their foot down, but if in the following year again there's an underspending, maybe if you can just get a clarity on that one. Thank you, Chair.
Before you respond, I would also want to add on the same question. My understanding of budget allocation is that you are not given money having not indicated the program that relates to the budget. The budget is the financial implications of the program. If then the under expenditure occurs, what would then have informed the allocation of the financial resources? And what would be the reason for understanding if what was given as financial resources was related to what was going to be done as a program. Because when you are planning, you'd put an overall objective of what you want to achieve, and below that there would be operational objectives, which are more of the activities and programs. And next to that, there would be the person or persons responsible, which indicates the human resource needed to execute that particular activity. And then on the following column, there would be a time frame to say when that would be done and achieved. And the next column would then say, because this activity requires so many human resources and so much time, it therefore requires so much money. How does it then happen that you would be given money based on the activity, the human resource required, and the time required to execute an activity? You are then given the money. How does it happen that when that has been allocated, it is not expended? Honorable Paul.
Thanks, Madam Chair. The CEO, in a part of the report that dealt with 2007-2008, indicates that the chairperson of the audit committee is not appointed. But as he dealt with part that relates to 2008-2009, this issue did not arise. My question would be whether the chairperson of the audit committee is appointed. If not, when is he going to be appointed? My following question, Chair, would be on the fact that the CEO indicates that the regulator will hold hearings and invite submissions on proposed tariff increases. My question would then be, who is expected to make the submission? A special interest group or members of the public? If it's members of the public, then which medium or tools are they utilized to advertise such kind of expected submissions? Thank you, Chair.
The other one from my side relates to the employment equity. On 2007-2008, under staff, we have 100% female in 2007-2008. And then on 2008-2009, we have 50% female, black, 25% male, black, and 25% male, white. Can you just explain what affected those changes?
Thank you, Chair. Can I just beg the indulgence of the committee and ask for a 5-minute body break? I'm sorry about this. But I mean, if it's not, I'm sure I can manage.
If it is going to be of help to you to give us accurate answers.
No, okay. We'll get accurate answers no matter how painful I am.
Quite.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and members. Thank you for the indulgence. The question that was raised by around the enforcement of corporatization. There's a clear role distinction which exists in the Act. The regulator is responsible for certain things, but fundamentally inside of the Act as to corporatization, that's a function of the Minister of Public Enterprises. So the corporatization of the NPA is something that the Minister of Public Enterprises must determine. And I mean, that's how the Act was written. So the regulator has no power or role or mandate to enforce the corporatization of the National Ports Authority. And nor is we wish such a power. In the Act clearly says that the Minister of Public Enterprises will determine when things happen, and certain things the access would happen at certain times. And there are certain elements that you need a whole range of ministers to agree upon. So there are processes which have been written into the Act to ensure that government policy is articulated through those processes and how the nuance occurs from time to time around that. In a sense, you cannot have a regulator set state policy. That's an inappropriate apportionment of power, because the members of parliament and the members in the executive, they represent the people of South Africa through an electoral process. In that process, they define the policy of the state. And it's not the regulator that defines the policy of the state. It's the state that defines the policy of the state. Obviously, depending on its makeup from whoever the ruling party is. So, I mean, that's not a regulator function to determine that. And as to enforcement, the regulator does not have, it's not a prosecutor where it will on its own determine that these are the things it should be chasing down and have a tribunal about that. Complaints and appeals are submitted to the regulator by interested parties. The regulator then sits and deals with those particular matters. And as to checking what has been implemented in the Act and what's in compliance, that is under the regulator's mandate. And the regulator, as of next year, will be giving monitoring and compliance report indicating compliance to the Act of the different players within the Act, etc. So that will occur as of next year. So we don't have any role to determine the corporatization or not, or the timing thereof of the NPA. That's purely articulated by the Act and managed by the Minister of Public Enterprises. As to respect to the ports being in chaos and amongst others, what members have to understand is that the regulator does not have the ability to do these things themselves. The regulator, in its tribunal capacity, must wait for ports members, port users to raise objections and complaints, etc. Now, there are a lot of complaints floating out there, but providing sound bites to the media is not sufficient. People need to approach the regulator, and they are aware of our existence, which we engage with them, and say, this is my formal complaint, this is the matter I want to raise, etc. But an example would be, is that the regulator doesn't have jurisdiction over certain elements of port activity, where a company is doing A, B, C, or D. The regulator doesn't have jurisdiction to hear such matters. The regulator hears matters where the NPA is involved, and where the NPA has not performed or something, or has performed something that it couldn't do. So that will be the main engagement. Where we will highlight these elements and bring it to the attention of all parties, including the members, would be in our compliance and monitoring function. We will say, these are the errors that are occurring in the system, these are the problems in the system, and these are the interventions possibly we could do amongst others. So on the monitoring and compliance side, that's where we would deal with those. With respect to the lease agreement process of the pre-1994 leases, there is an element in the Act which allows the NPA to start addressing those things and to change the nature of things, so that these evergreen contracts which were granted to people in the apartment era aren't allowed to continue to exist at the expense of the efficiency of the port, and also specifically blocking out new entrants into the port environment. And from what we understand, I mean, we don't have all the information, we're still waiting for the NPA to give us all the information we require, is that they've started working on some of those elements already. As to the speed of the implementation, members may not be comfortable with, but they have, as far as I know, they have a program working on that matter. When we have the information, we'll be able to raise it in our compliance reporting. With respect to the audit of the current leases, that's one of the things that we're doing to understand. That's the information we've been asking the NPA, which they haven't been giving us. We've been asking them, tell us the leases, the licenses, what do they pay per year, who owns, who's got the right to that lease or license, what are the restrictions on transfer. So if we have a situation where a B company gets a lease and then 3 months later somebody buys out the whole company and you have the same company owning all the leases, we need to understand what those restrictions are just on transfer. With respect to the fruitless and wasteful expenditure, I think the member asked the Department of Transport to respond to that.
Okay, with regard to the fruitless expenditure, the person who was responsible for processing of payments to the post regulator was transferred to the post regulator, which is Mr. Ibi Faki, who is now appointed as the board secretary at the post regulator. And then in that process, there was someone who was employed to perform that function. And as the CEO has indicated, we have rectified the problem. There is someone in that position who is responsible for the processing of payments to the post regulator. And it should also be noted that this is an interim arrangement until the post regulator has enough capacity to process its own finances and its own payments. That function would be transferred to the post regulator. Thank you.
I would like to make a follow-up on that.
Here in Parliament, if I can't chair the meeting for any reason, whether I am sick or my child is sick or I am on a trip, there is another member that performs that duty to ensure that the system continues, the wheel keeps on turning. Does it then mean that in the Department of Transport, if one particular individual is shifted from a desk where I have just processed a payment, the wheel stops turning? Here today, we have Ovuyoga Mafili writing exam. She is the secretary to the committee. And in her place, the meeting did not stop. We are not going to have a meeting next week without minutes because Ovuyoga was writing exam. We have Oanel doing that. So next week we will have meetings, although Yoga was writing exams. Do you mean to tell us that in the Department of Transport, we have to incur a fruitless expenditure just because one person could not sit in front of the desk? There is no one from the department who could have substituted that function. The result of that is that we lose money as a country.
So I think you have covered me partially, but maybe to just as a committee, to get it clearly when Mr. Faki was transferred to the court, yes, and also how long did it take for the department to replace him? Because we can't allow a situation where we accumulate such a fruitless expenditure of this amount. This is a public fund. At the end of the day, we have to account for this fund. So how long did it take to replace Mr. Faki after he has been transferred to the department?
Thank you, Chair. The department would like to put it forward that we completely regret this position of having wasted this money. That is not the nature of this government. We don't want that, and we have put systems in place to address matters of this nature going forward. Mr. Faki was transferred to the, or seconded to the board's regulator in 2007. In the presentation of the CEO, he pointed out that the CEO was appointed in June 2008. The members, out of the resolution that was adopted by the members in 2007, it became necessary that we deploy Mr. Faki to the port regulator to initiate administrative processes, amongst others, ensure that things are getting started. Unfortunate thing is that in the process, I mean, immediately after that happened, the department happened to ensure that we don't just let Mr. Faki from the port regulator process, invoices on behalf of the port regulator without somebody inside the department doing that dual checking of the work call. However, the PFMA is clear that we need to process payments within the 30 days what called for a period. We needed to do the checks and balances through the offices, first office of the financial oversight and also the office of the CFO. In doing that, time elapsed such that it went beyond the 30 days period. The eventual thing is that we happened to incur fruitless and wasteful expenditure. It was not such that it was just left behind, but we needed to do some checks and balances to make sure that payments are processed. And over and above, we would like to say that right now we have got systems in place. We have got the person appointed to deal with the transfers of money to the public entities. It unfortunately took some time to recruit this person and get this person to do the job in a more efficient manner. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, I think this is an oversight. This is the oversight committee of Parliament. I hope and believe that it is a person who was supposed to make sure that when Mr. Faki is being transferred to the port regulator, who will continue with the work. Who is that person? Because that person is the one who is supposed to pay this money. We can't allow a situation whereby things are being done willy-nilly. They were supposed to have a plan in place that although they shift, they transfer Mr. Faki from the department to the regulator. What plans are in place to make sure that the functions that he was doing, they still continue, they are not stopped? Because we can't allow such a fruitless expenditure to continue. Because next year, we're going to have millions and millions of fruit expenditure if we take this 13,000 light. Maybe we can just get an indication who is that person who is responsible to make sure that when this transfer takes place as a person, then I think we have to continue from there. Because that person must account for this man and must pay back the man.
I think here we should be very clear of what we are dealing with. As much as we are dealing with a fruitless expenditure, but we are also dealing with an attitude. There is a lot of noise that is made outside there. If it is a member of parliament or a minister, very less noise that is made if it is an official. As if officials have a license to do things in a very relaxed manner. It is not a waste of taxpayers' money if it is done by an official. We have seen situations where government would lose money because an official picked up a problem, maybe of a difference of 2 rands in an invoice. and an official would not pick up the phone and alert the person who has sent an invoice to do the correction. But instead of picking up the phone, which costs much less than the penalties, the invoice would sit on a desk for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, and only after the inquiry by the person who was expected to receive the payment would then an explanation be given that when I was reconciling the figures, I picked up that you had miscalculated by 2 rand, and therefore I could not process your payment. But you don't even alert the person that you have to change the invoice. And what then happens during that time, when that situation occurs, the relationship between the person who has sent the invoice and the government becomes sour. It is a government that is not caring. The second issue that happens is that that person incurs more costs and therefore does not continue with the project in a manner that was supposed to, because can't meet the cash flow becomes a problem. And we have seen companies closing down because of that. And by the time you are expected to finish the project, you are then the cost of the things that you are using to continue with the project have escalated, and then even the service delivery suffers. So it's not just an issue of 13,000 that we are dealing with. We are dealing with a much bigger problem of the attitude that results with much bigger problems and an egg on the face of the government. And who gets that egg on the face? It's mainly the ruling party. And we are here as representatives of the ruling party. So we want that egg wiped out from our face and assure, to give us an assurance that you have systems in place that are dealing with those issues. That comes to the department. But for the regulator, I still want to understand the issue of the under expenditure. The under expenditure and the program. Because in my understanding, the money is a financial implication of a program. And from where I sit, I would look at the money, whether it was spent on the program that it was asked for, but also I would look at the relevance of the program and the strategic plan in as far as the ruling party that went out and got the vote promised to the people, and the problems that the strategic plan aimed to address, and development that was expected we expected to achieve as a result of the plan. So for me, the less expenditure in relation to what was given and what was used is more about the work that has not been done. And if there is money that was given without a plan, how did that money arrive? How was it arrived at that you had to get this money without a plan?
So let me deal with that matter first, or when it comes to first. Okay. We have to look at the expenditure under expenditure amongst others. Under the period in which it occurred. The first period, which would be 2007-2008, please correct, there was no strategic plan in place. The regulator members had their first meeting in March that year. What had occurred is that budgetary allocation, there has been a preliminary budget has been developed by the Department of Transport officials inside of the Public Entity Oversight Unit, which had predicted a 3-year spending cycle for certain amounts and certain programs which they thought the regulator would put into place and implement. So when the regulator was established for that first year, in actual fact, the DOT acted de facto as the secretariat of the regulator. I'm not sure when, December 2007, it was a conference. March 2007. So, in effect, what happened, the strategic control of the expenditure of the regulator occurred inside the Department of Transport for that particular year. So they had oversight over what the money was used for, etc. But they had predicted the 3-year cycle of that particular expenditure. But then subsequently happened in the year 2008. At the end of 2008, the regulator developed a corporate plan which is submitted to the Department of Transport, setting out the strategy, what it wanted to spend the money on, etc. I think an initial amount of 21,000 was requested, 21 million was requested. The department did not sign off on it, but there was no performance agreement signed in that particular year. The number was reduced to 11,382,000. So of the 21 requested, 11 million has been provided. But there was no performance agreement signed with respect to that particular year. The year that we're talking about, which is 8-9. There is a performance agreement in place for 9-10. So the expenditure in 9-10 would occur on the basis of what we have submitted in the estimate of national expenditure and the programs against which we stand. We do hope that the committee will give us an opportunity to come back and take the committee through the program and the strategy, etc., to pinpoint what the activities are going to be, what are the elements that have already been achieved, etc., to a much greater extent than we can do in this particular one. So perhaps start the process of doing that before we even go into our next financial year, etc.
Can I get clarity on that? I don't understand the response in that the post regulatory authority didn't establish itself. It didn't give birth to itself. It came as a result of government and a department in particular, charged with the responsibility of that. And if that is the situation, in my layman point of view, it is the department that would have developed at that time a strategic plan for the establishment of the airport regulator, including also one, the overall objectives, the specific objectives, the operational objectives, the human resources that are required, the time frame, and the financial implications. And when the post-regulation authority is in existence, it will then continue on that. And in that process, it would reflect on the plan that the strategic plan that founded it to see whether the plan is in congruence with what is being discovered on the ground. And if there was a need to change the plan, they would then, the authority would then change the plan in accordance to what it is discovering on the ground. Now, where I don't understand your response is, how would there be money, 21 million, allocated without a strategic plan that relates to the founding statement and objective of the very same entity that is being founded? To me, that points a finger again at the department that the department established that entity, it is in place, there is money, but there are no clear, there is no clear strategic plan and clear goals. It is then expected to find its own feet on the ground. Is that what happened?
Let me say that for the 07-08 financial year, I've not been able to see the plan. I mean, I got there in July 2008, and there was no plan for 07-08. But, I mean, in effect, what happened is the members came there, and I mean, it's a complaint which the members can raise themselves, which they had raised, saying that the expectations that were going to come into this organization and they were just going to be like non-executive directors sitting on something where there was a clear plan to follow, etc. But what they found was that they had to build something out of scratch and there was no plan for what the building should be. So it's a complaint which is often raised by the regulator members. For 07-08, there was no plan. I don't know if there is a plan that I haven't seen, but I haven't seen, DOT can tell us if there was a plan for 07-08. For 08-09, there was a plan submitted, the regulators had put together on the basis of what they presumed would occur. It was submitted to the Department of Transport. There wasn't a performance agreement signed, if I remember correctly. Subsequent to once we were already in the DOT had come back and said that they had concerns about the plan, but they hadn't articulated the concerns to the extent that both parties could sit together and finalize the plan. Because I had to go back into East Street to try and discover what had occurred. For this year, we covered, we've got a plan, we've got a strategy, all those elements, and we've got expenditure priorities amongst others, which have been articulated against the national priorities, job creation, etc., etc. So we've got that, right, with respect to compliance, but what you're raising is a more substantive matter than compliance, Chair. It's not only about whether you formally comply. The question that you're asking is that what was the regulator doing and spending money on if there was no plan for it to do so in a particular way? And part of the process what they were doing was deciding, in that year, if you look at the expenditure, sorry, Chair, to draw your attention to administration.
No, that's not what I'm asking. What I'm saying is, No, that's not what my question is. My question is, let's say I am the department. I am charged with the responsibility of establishing the port authority, the port regulator authority. The first thing that I would do, because it's something that is established because a problem has been identified, and the choice that is being being made in dealing with the problem is that a port regulator authority has to be established. And if I am the founding organization, the founding, I'm the father and the mother of this child that is being born, I would spell out exactly what would be the roles and responsibilities of this child. And when I give birth to this child, I will say, this is what I have given birth to you for you to do. The purpose clearly spelled out. And I am also giving you the financial resources, the human resources, and the material resources to execute the mandate that I am establishing you for. And Parliament would then measure whether it was the correct decision to establish the post authority, the post regulator authority, on the basis of the founding document and the papers document. And also Parliament would measure the progress that is being made in as far as addressing the problem that informed the establishment of the entity. And along the way, in the process of evaluation of progress and impact, changes would be made. When those changes then are made, it is when the new strategic plan developed by the Port Authority kicks in, because it is beginning to identify the realities on the ground informed by the conditions that are changing in relation to what was seen in the beginning, which may not be the true picture. You can't find something and have no plan. So that is the question we are asking as to your response to the under expenditure is that there was no capacity, and we are saying there was no plan. We are saying there was no plan. And that resulted with money being allocated without clear indications of how this money was going to be utilized, what activities were going to be undertaken through this money. The money was not the financial implications of a program. And the program was not a response to the problem.
Just with respect to 0708, that is indeed the case. There was no plan. There were no key outputs which were articulated. There was a generalized identification of the mandate, the act, and the members were given the responsibility to implement. As to the objectives, they weren't clearly defined. They weren't in your correct. There was no plan. I mean, I haven't been able to find one. With respect to 0809, there was a formal plan for impact which was submitted, but there was no finalized perspective on that, so in effect, there wasn't a plan for 0809 either. So only for 910 is there a budgeted plan. With respect to the under expenditure, I mean, that is a clear component that if you are not sure what you should be spending money on, you should, in all likelihood, underspend or overspend and spend in the wrong area for that matter. What the regulator did was to take a very cautious approach to things. In that there is no clear articulation of what we should be doing. Let's do the things that we know we cannot do without. Like you need an office to house the people, etc., those kinds of things. And that's what the regulator did in the period leading up to that. You know, 8 or 9, there was a plan, although it wasn't formally accepted, whatever, but it was an indication from the regulator saying, this is what we find. In the absence of a plan, this is what we find, what we think we must do, this is what we, how much money we think we need to do, which is 21. The department came back and said, no, you've only got 11.3 million and that's for the plan. For this particular year, we have all those things in place, but for the previous years, we didn't.
So you are correct in what you're saying.
So even now, the financial resources allocated are not informed by the plan. It is the financial resources that are available.
That's correct, Chair, because the expenditure that was supposed to occur, I mean, if you look at the pattern of expenditure going forward, I'm not sure if this is as long as the wrong numbers. It's for 9-10, it's 12,945. When you go to 10-11, it becomes 8.8 million. And then 11-12 is 9.3 million. If you look at the organogram, which was raised by one of the other members, for all the functions of the regulator, if you had to implement all the functions of the regulator immediately, you need to spend about 21 to 25 million. Now, currently, in actual fact, it's gone up to 12.9 and it's now going down to 9. So, obviously, the regulator has got to ensure that it doesn't, in this year, it hasn't put any recurring expenditure into place which it wouldn't be able to afford next year. So, in actual fact, correctly, as you articulated, what is in the plan is a response to the money that's available rather than saying this is what we should be doing and that's the money that we need for it.
Is that how we are actually expected to do things? That we will start by allocating money and then say, this is all you have, my child. Try and see how much food you can get out of this. And then out there, the problem remains unchanged because the plan and the resources do not match. And although the plan would match the problems that are required to be addressed, then the financial allocation would not be to both the plan and the problem. And then at the end of the day, we would be saying we are failing to deliver. When we have no plan, we give more resources. When we have a plan, we allocate less resources. Is that how we are expected to function?
Thank you, Chair. I don't think that the way we are expected to function, the program should be budgeted for. There should be a list of programs that are going to be undertaken in addressing the mandate of the organization, and those programs should talk to the budget that's available, that there should be costing of the activities of the regulator. And for this financial year, there is a strategic plan, and there is also the financials that talk to the strategic plan and the programs that will be undertaken by the regulator. And there is also a performance agreement in place approved by the minister, where the cost regulator will be monitored on a quarterly basis on their performance. And we would like to assure the committee that there will be the proper monitoring of the regulator to ensure that it performs according to its mandate. And the department would also support the programs and the functions of the regulator to perform according.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. Just for interest's sake, the regulator does monitoring and okay, let me just say monitoring for compliance and so on. That I understand, you can put that in your program for the year, or I'm going to monitor this one and that one. It's very easy to do that. But it also does adjudication
and the appeals, those surely you can't say you are going to have 15 appeals and 18 complaints. Not possible. Can you just give me an idea how do you budget for that? Do you just put some money aside or maybe, or just to have an idea how you would budget for an appeal? And then the second question would be, would I be right that the regulator is dealing with complaints and also appeals at the same time? It means somebody brings a complaint to me and then I give a decision, the person appeals, come back to me again. If that's the way it works. Thank you, Comrade Chair.
Go back to the, there are a couple of questions in between that I've had prepared and finished, so I'm going to make sure that all the members' questions are answered. The, with respect to the question about the audit committee in line with section 79, there is an audit chair. Currently there's an audit committee with the audit chair. What we have been advised by the auditor general is that it's more appropriate to have an independent chair of the audit committee. So somebody who is not a member sitting as the chair of the audit committee. So in actual fact, that's what we do have an audit chair, but it's one of the members. We are in the process of appointing an audit chair that is not a member, so an outsider that can sit in oversight of the audit process inside of the regulator. So that is the comment to speak to the chair. Why the financial statements were late to the AG in 2000?
On that issue of the audit committee, I agree with the advice from the AG, but really the paper may on how should the audit committee be established. Because if the audit committee is being established by people who are within the entity, there should be an approval from the treasurer. Because while I was looking at the audit committee members, all of them are within the entity, which is against the paper. So I think they have to just relook at that section, whether they have complied with that section of the PFMA, and how should the audit committee be composed of.
If I can just make a comment, Madam Chair. I think the one thing that we should appraise the members of is that the establishment of the port regulator, when the members, or now the members were approached, it was with the view of, as Rian has said, being independent, non-executive directors of an entity. And that actually changed. And it was only, I would say, I think probably towards the end of last year, that new letters were written by the Department of Transport, actually saying we are members and not independent directors. So at the time that things were established, it was on a different basis, and things were subsequently changed. But the other thing that I suppose I'm not understanding is what being referred to as part of the entity, which actually is not correct. The only role that we play as members is an oversight, because of the separation between members and day-to-day management, and where we can be perceived to be playing an active role within the structure of the port regulator is in line with the requirements of the Act when it comes specifically to the tribunal. So even I would be delighted to understand that the requirements of an independent chair, unless they're actually saying that the members themselves are not independent.
Thank you, Chair. We have taken into consideration those particular elements, and with the AG, they have indicated what their advice is, and therefore we're following their specific advice. Correct whatever has been found. With respect to the financial statements related to the AG 2007 and 2008, I mean, the reality is that the members don't actually sit in the day-to-day running and operation of the organization. In actual fact, there was nobody, because Mr. Farkey was, he's the board secretary, he was not really a part of the secretariat in that particular sense. So when I came on board in July 2008, what I indeed was initiated the process. One has to understand that the members, although they have an obligation to perform and do things, etc., they have an obligation to be realistic with the application of state money. And just, and they sent out adverts and TORs for the drafting of the financial results for that year. And there were 200 transactions in that year. And in actual fact, the prices that came back were in the 600,000 and 500,000 just to draw the set of financials. And in fact, it would have translated in some cases, depending on the thing, to something like 5,000 Rand per line item. So if somebody had bought a pencil for 25 Rand a pen, it would cost you 5,000 Rand to write it up into the book. So that delayed the process, because there's no way that the members could sign up such expensive service providers to do those kinds of things. So when I came on board, I went through a process and got accountants to do the process for us. And in actual fact, we then had all the financials settled and we submitted it to the AG. So we did submit it late, but it's due to the fact that there was no staff in the regulator at that time, and there were also problems with the cost of service providers that are willing to do the particular function. Let's just speak to that part. How many offices? We only have one office based in Durban. The rental is 59,000 Rand for the entire offices. It's the only office that we have. We don't have any other facilities. Come on. Square meters. 770. And so that's for the total complement of the regulation. With respect to the organogram has been submitted to the DOT for this particular financial year. We've given them the entire organogram and what we can afford at the moment. So we've only populated a part of the organogram, because we can't afford the whole organogram. We can afford it maybe in this year towards now, and we have a problem affording it next year and the following year. So we've got to look at what we can do in the outer years. With respect to limited operation in place for what's being done about it with respect to the audit amongst others, is that those limited operation comments were mainly around 2007-2008 with respect to some of the things not being done. But with respect to the subsequent year, and even to a certain extent now, there are some instances where, because we have such a limited operation, it doesn't actually make sense for us to transfer the whole financial function across to the regulator. Because one of the key elements in fraud prevention and financial management is to separate out the procurement of something from the payment of something. Now, if you in effect only have at one stage two employees to make those decisions in terms of separating out procurement and payment and ensuring that the fraud prevention plan in the way we articulated is implemented, we actually don't have enough levels in the organization implemented as yet to be able to do this. So it's not a function of operation was limited, it's about the conscious decision to say leave it in the DOT from the 1st of November this year, but when we take the effective transfer, there will then be sufficient operations where it's actually separated. With respect to the performance management system in place, it's being we've articulated the perspective running out of what the Department of Transport signed off, cascaded that down to smaller levels and that down into individual tasks for people, and that will be the process on which performance management is managed. Also, we report back to the Department of Transport on those performance measures which have been articulated in the performance agreement, but it's only for the 9-10 year, not for the 8-9 year. So we never had that in place for the 8-9 year, because there was no sign up on the performance agreement with the Department of Transport. With respect to hearing and submission to the public special interest, the hearing and submission, I just want to raise a question about the restaurants. The way in which we've written the directives, we have to go out on an advert which is in two languages, English and the language which is the most common language spoken in that area, so whether it's Afrikaans, Xhosa, or whatever. So what we would do is we would advertise in a local paper in an area where anybody that would or could be affected by the tariffs would advertise in the two languages most commonly used. They would then, people would respond, we tell them which date and when and the venue, etc., and what date for the submission. So they'd be allowed to make submissions, written submissions, but also we'll give them the date of where those venues are so that they can come and give oral submissions, because in some instances people prefer to give oral submissions and not written submissions. And they are open to the general public, because one of the problems with special interest group delimitation is if we start saying that those are the people that affect the port, that are affected by port tariffs, next week we could keep out a whole bunch of other people. An example may be around the subsistence fishermen around Durban as an example. So we have to put out an advert and say, all persons who are affected by this, please come and present your perspective. So it's not only for special interest groups, the hearing and submissions are for everybody. With respect to the employment equity in 2007, 2008, and 2009, and how those changes occur, is that initially, if one looks at 2007, 2008, there were only two employees. It was E.B. Parkey and Peter Shiva. And together, he was 100% management and there was 100% staff. And then in the next year, it becomes a lot more people. And this is weighted, that 25%, 25%, 25%, etc. That's weighted over the year, because the contractor, for example, would come in and work on a specific thing and it work for 3 months. And somebody else would come and work for 6 months. That's weighted across that entire year. So the numbers therefore would change. With respect to the complaints and appeals and no way of predicting them, in actual fact, the member is very correct. I mean, we have a 3 million rand under expenditure projected, precisely because we had estimated that on the basis of the engagement with industry and people coming to us and talking to us about it, we had estimated we would get a lot more tribunal activity. So what we did in the measures was not to say 15 matters or 35 matters or whatever, but look at the minimum amount of days that members would make themselves available for hearing. So if members, and in this financial year, for example, it's 35 days that members would make themselves available across a particular year. Now, we only got the directors, was only approved and published on the 6th of August. So from that period, there would be 35 days members making available, but in actual fact, we won't get to those 35 days because we've only got one complaint to date, and any of the other complaints, they would come in and then there'd be the process of passing paper and run to them. But it was the availability of the members that we predicted and budgeted. So we budgeted, what does it cost us to move the members all to one place, sit down, have a hearing, what are the costs of their flights, etc., etc., what are the costs of advisors for 35 days to help members with specific legal interpretations, which are really advanced amongst others. So we calculated on the availability that if we require, we would be able to use a maximum of X amount of days for the tribunal, taking into consideration that all the members are part-time. So with respect to complaints and appeals, the appeal is not to an appeal of the regulator's decision. There are two different classifications of matters that we hear. We hear a complaint, which is where if a person wants to complain about something, it could be something not necessarily inside of the port that's affected by it. Right? And on the other hand, it's an appeal where somebody has gone to NPA and said, we want to do A, and NPA has said no and given it to them in writing. Then we would be sitting as the appeal. We would have appeal jurisdiction around that decision, but we would not be appealing our own matters. The appeal of decisions of the regulator is in the outside in the courts.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if I could just add something which might complete the puzzle which I think you face. You and the members have faced about our underspending and the low level of activity. you asked at the beginning of this meeting if members could mention some of the challenges that we face, and two of the challenges are these. The CEO has already mentioned that the members of the regulator are part-time members, and so without exception, every time a member makes him or herself available for work relating to the regulator, it has an adverse impact on their own businesses. And so inevitably there is only a certain amount of time that members are capable of making themselves available. That in and of itself has slowed down the implementation process of the regulator. The other issue is this question of directives. If you like, the directives are the regulator's handbook of procedures, and without those directives, the regulator has been emasculated. We've been unable to do anything. Now, when the members of the regulator were appointed, one of the things that was given to the regulator was a draft set of directives which the Department of Transport had put out to tender, and it was handed over to the members, and we were told to get on with it. Now, on analysis of that document, with respect to the draftsman of the regulatory committee of the members concluded that the document is hopelessly inadequate. And we are faced with trying to panel beat the directives into some sort of shape or form that is more acceptable and more in line with the objectives and mandate under the Act, or rewriting them from scratch. And we took a view that we would try and work with what we had, and on a part-time basis, members of the regulatory committee spent an enormous amount of time trying to put those into some sort of shape which was acceptable. The CEO came on board during that process, and we got them to a point which we thought was all right. We then put them out for comments, and we received some very sensible comments from some of the stakeholders in the industry, but we also received comments from the main stakeholder, the NPA, which exceeded in length the actual directives themselves, and it put our process into complete disarray. We then had to put our directives back out to tender in order to deal with all the objections from the NPA. And those objections, some of them we believe were frivolous, some of them were acceptable, most of them seemed to be about minimizing the amount of regulation that they would need to endure. And so the entire process of enabling those directives has taken an enormously long period of time through, I would suggest, no fault of the regulator or its members, but just because of the process we had to go through in order to try and get them through. And as the CEO said, they were only published in August of this year. But in the context of that, of having no enabling instruments, there was no point in filling up an office with employees who basically had nothing to do. And that is a large part of the context for the underspend that you've heard about. And it just occurred to me that it would be helpful for you to understand that particular picture. Having said that, I think that we are very well on track now, having those directives in place. And expenditure of our budget will be far more efficient in this year and the years going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson.
very much. I think we have deliberated well enough on this issue, and I think we have identified from our side what we think are the challenges that are related to underspending and also to all other issues that we have interrogated you on. We also appreciate that you have been able to, on your own, put forward to us what you see as challenges. And as much as we hold you accountable, but we also have a bigger role than holding you accountable. The role of ensuring that what happens in all the entities that fall under transport, we also become part of the solution to try and find ways in which you'll be able to do your job and execute your mandate in a more efficient manner. And it is based on that point of departure that we are harsh, but at the same time, we find solutions together with you. We will become more harsher if what is then identified as a challenge remains unaddressed, even when we have both agreed that this is a challenge that needs to be addressed. You have our full commitment from our side that whatever intervention that is required from the side of Parliament and the Portfolio Committee will be a given. We also expect that in executing your mandate, we will be able to see change in as far as the problems that necessitated the establishment of the post regulator were concerned. I think that at the end of the day, when we have engaged with all entities, we do produce a report to Parliament that actually informs Parliament of what we see and what we are recommending as changes that need to be done. And we don't think that this is the last time that we are interacting with you. We think that it's an ongoing process. We would appreciate a situation where the department is also able to deal with its own challenges that are related to the performance of the entities that account and report to the department. Having said that, I would then thank you, all of you, for having come forward to make these presentations, both the board and the administration within the Port Authority. That brings us to the end of this item of the agenda. And we will then be dealing with the second item of the minutes of the previous meeting. I thank you all.
Can we just extend our thanks to the committee and the support, but specifically to the committee for the leadership and direction, because we will be taking into consideration and reverting back to the committee with what in actual fact has changed our plan. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Can we then move to item number 4 in terms of the agenda, which is the minutes of the previous meeting? We are on page 1 of the meeting, of the minutes, page 2. Page 3 and page 4.
have a mover and a seconder of the minutes. Mabila Ngwenya is moving for the adoption of the minutes. And a seconder? Seconder, thank you very much. I declare the meeting closed.